Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial for Citywire in the US of A, and I'm joined by Citywire RAA Editor Ian Wenig and live in person in the studio, Citywire RAA Deputy Editor Andrew Forsch, who's made it all the way up from Washington, D.C. for this, our first episode of the year. So, Andrew, Ian, welcome. Andrew, how are you feeling?
Yeah, wonderful. It's nice to be here. Nice to be in the studio with you all to start the year.
Excellent. And Ian, I mean, I assume our listeners think that we never leave the studio. We just sort of live here and talk about RAAs all day. But nice to be back. Happy to be here.
Yes, very happy. I did eject Andrew from my usual spot. I did inform that he was throwing off the vibe of the room.
Oh, he tried to sit there?
He did try to sit there.
I had to assert my authority. Yeah, he had to.
In my fraternity in college, you know, you could get someone to move out of their seat by asserting their PIN number if you ranked higher in your pledge class than them. So I was pulling rank on Andrew.
Very quickly, because I'm not sure about this segue at all, but what's their PIN number? As in their, like, their chip for their bank?
Like, you got a number for what number member you were to join the chapter. So like, okay. I was 1584, then the last person dead last in the pledge class got 1600.
So if you next came year before 1601. Them, you yes. outranked them.
Seniority.
So you could tell them to move. What else could you do?
I mean, it was
I don't really want to get, you know.
No, it was never really invoked that often, but it was mostly used to eject people from their chairs.
Okay, it sounds a little bit sort of British boarding school, which is, again, not a tangent we need to pursue today. Anyway, look, we're not here for this, although obviously it's all gold and it's all going to stay in. We're here, as ever, to talk about the biggest stories in the world of RAAs this week. And yeah, look, it's only really been 3-4 days of 2026, because no one was working last Friday, let's be honest. But already, there's been a ton of stories. There's been a lot going on. We think, at least, the two biggest ones involve a new referral program from Goldman Sachs and one of the country's largest RAAs raising their fees quite significantly. And Andrew, it's convenient that you're here because these are both your stories. So let's kick off with that Goldman Sachs referral program. So it's not, well, it's from, I get this name wrong, ACO? Am I saying it right? I always lean to ICO, but it's ACO. So it's ACO, and it's going to make referrals to RIAs. And so far, we know, you have reported exclusively, the two large RAAs. So in this case, Mercer being one and the other being Wealth Enhancement Group, who we're no longer allowed to call WEG. We have to just call them Wealth Enhancement.
That's correct.
Good. All right. Loads of questions. Before we get to it, give us a sort of skinny on the story.
Well, you've done a fair job summarizing kind of what we know, which is Goldman is going to begin referring certain clients of its ACO business, which is its executive financial counseling division, out to at least these two and possibly more independent RIAs. I think at this stage, honestly, I have more questions than answers. There's a lot that's uncertain, including exactly what this program will cost in terms of the ongoing fee charged by Goldman to the RIA participants. And we also don't know, really anybody other than these two firms that is going to participate. These are the two that we know have disclosed their participation, but it is likely that there are others that we just don't know about right now. It seems like this program is in its kind of early nascent stages of coming online, so maybe further developments to come.
Okay, and it's not completely out of the blue because, Ian, you broke last year, maybe even last April, I think, that Goldman was considering this kind of thing.
Yes, you hit the nail right on the head. It was early April, I believe it was, April 9th. We wrote that Goldman was considering this. And what was fascinating was that when we wrote about it back then, it was tied to ACO, as we're kind of discussing now, as opposed to being purely tied to the custody business, as is unlike the Schwab program or the Fidelity program.
Right, this is it. So the classic referral. Obviously, there's loads of ways you can get referrals. Those are types of businesses. But the classic kind of like big provider to RAA referral relationship has been these large custodians and which also, in the case of Fidelity and Schwab, happened to have large brokerage networks. And effectively, when a client gets too big or too sophisticated for those firms, brokers to sort of handle in-house, they will refer out to a network of larger RIAs, and there'll be a kind of fee split on the ongoing AUM charge.
Yeah.
And this isn't that. So it's confusing because Goldman does have a custody business, but this, we don't know for a fact. Well, we do. Help me out here, Andrew. Are these firms part of it?
Yeah. So when Ian wrote his story, the idea or kind of the prevailing knowledge among people familiar with you know, the situation was that this referral program would not be tied to the custody business. Now, I guess it's sort of unclear at the moment. Goldman has not confirmed that to us, but we know that Mercer does have a custody agreement with Goldman's custodian. I do not technically know if Wealth Enhancement also has such an agreement. They have not disclosed one to regulators, although that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have something, or possibly they have something in the works. Both firms do work with Goldman on the banking side, though, for things like deposit products, lending products, and those disclosures are all public in ADVs. So, you know, I think there are some.
And they might, I suppose, also be clients of Goldman in other ways too. They might be. We don't know that this is tied to this. We're not saying it is, but it'd be worth observing that they might also have other relationships around products,
private funds, assets, ETFs, yeah, exactly,
private right, funds yeah. or whatever. But A, we don't know that's the case, and B, even if it were, we're not drawing a hard line between that and getting referrals. But
yeah, that's another question. Is I would be curious what. I would be curious what triggers a referral. How does a company actually become eligible to receive a referral of a particular client? And I would wonder about the volume of referrals that are going to flow through this channel, given that ACO provides financial planning to corporate executives. I mean, that's exactly the work that RIAs want to do with corporate executives. So I guess it remains to be seen the size and type of client that will ultimately flow through that channel.
Yeah, okay, so this is another sort of big difference between, say, the Schwab and Fidelity referrals, which largely are when a client gets too, we said complex, sophisticated, but another way of saying it is has too much money, effectively, gets too big. They go out to the RIA, which can sort of service all of their needs, perhaps, or more of their needs. Whereas here, could one... Is it crazy to think that actually they'll be referring clients who are too small for ACO,
right? ACO, because ACO Goldman's got its own in-house ultra high net worth focused wealth management arm, which is not PFM. It's private
PWM.
Wealth. Yeah, what is that? Private wealth management.
Yes. PFM was the business it sold.
PFM was sold. United. That's right. Capital, that was the old United Capital, which sold to Creative Planning. So not that, but they've got a separate. Similarly acronymed division, which is PWM. And so you would think if a client or a family is too big for ACO.
Too big or too complex, it would
graduate up there.
If it's in ACO's wheelhouse, it stays with them. So right. So you could think, although we don't know all this, but yeah, you could think it might end up being the smaller clients that go there.
Exactly right.
Okay. Where does this sort of fit then in the wider kind of referral world then, Ian? So we've touched on the big two that everyone knows about. And we've talked quite a lot last year about the changes that Schwab made to San.
Yes, you got that one on the first try.
Thank you very much. Although there was one little change that it made between when we last recorded and today, right?
Yes, that's true. So we report along with several other publications that Schwab is doubling the AUM threshold to be part of SAN.
The overall AUM threshold for the firm.
Yes.
Because we had already broken earlier in the year that it had.
And we did not break this one, to give credit where credit is due. So the threshold has doubled from 250 million in client assets for an RIA to be eligible to 500 million. So they're moving up market a little bit, relatively speaking, too.
And very quickly, just to recap, because I think we talked about it a lot last year, the other changes that it made were the fee that you pay.
Yes, they raised fees by 5%, and then they quadrupled the minimum asset threshold that a client needed to have to be referred out to a SAN advisor.
Okay, got it. So they made a number of changes. And there have, so there's obviously, now this is a new sort of referral network, although right now two firms, and as we've discussed, not sort of directly related to being a custodian client. But we also saw sort of the emergence of a few other sort of referral networks.
So it's worth noting that we reported on Pershing, rival custodian, that they've begun working on a similar referral program as well. It's also worth noting that Pershing...
Again, though, very quickly, just sorry to interrupt. Difference being they haven't got that kind of network of brokers at Fidelity.
Yes, literally what I was about to say.
I'm very sorry, listen, Alan. I'm very sorry, Ian.
So that's one factor. Then we also now have Robinhood. They acquired Trade PMR. They're going to eventually introduce a referral network themselves. And what's interesting is that Robinhood, you're talking about this massive base of self-directed brokerage users that will have complex needs. They'll come into a large sum of money very fast, maybe faster than they're able to handle. But it has a client base of people that are fiercely independent and may not necessarily want advice. If you have diamond hands, you don't necessarily want to work with an RIA.
Yeah, or I wonder even if you did, whether as an RIA you want those clients, because you're there preaching the virtues of sort of passive diversification, and
they've made their fortunes doing exactly the opposite.
Yeah, 27-year-old bro in a gaming chair, you know, yayed up on
shorting
energy drinks, telling you that he just wants, you know, options.
The pitch for using an RIA to one of those bros would be, yes, you got rich by making a massive asymmetric bet on yourself. You stay rich by diversifying. You don't want to YOLO it all back away.
Yeah. Well, you should work for them, Ian, because it's a compelling pitch. We've also made some massive generalizations there about Robinhood users, which is, you know, incredibly unfair. So apologies to any of them listening. Okay, excellent. Well, yeah, fantastic. Very interesting story. We will watch this space to see, you know, what emerges, I suppose, in, you know, with that referral network. And hopefully we get answers to some of our questions and be interesting. I think most interesting to see sort of how many referrals are made and what they are.
Yeah, okay. Is participation even going to be fruitful for those firms? We don't know yet.
We should say, I suppose, that, you know, they're not naive firms, Mercer.
Yeah, these are leading national brands.
Wealth Enhancement Group, they're big, they're leading, they've got, you know, they'll be part of the other networks too. So, you know, there must be something in it for them to have bothered. Let's move on to our second story, which also involves Mercer and also involves Andrew. So look, I'm not going to trail this one too much and leave you with nothing to say. So just what's the story?
Yeah, so Mercer has raised some of its fee minimums. So not its AUM-based fees, but it's got kind of a minimum annual fee for clients, particularly low-dollar clients who do not currently have the AUM to generate that number or that amount of AUM fees on a basis points kind of model. So what has happened is three of its kind of mass affluent or retail investing focused service tracks, those annual fee minimums have come up, and they've come up quite a bit on a relative basis. So each of those three tracks, the minimum fee has been raised by 50%, which sounds like quite a bit. And again, in relative terms, it is quite a bit. So just to walk you through briefly what those three tracks are, one of them is guided investing. This is basically portfolio management alone. It's kind of an accommodation for existing clients. Maybe you've got somebody who wants to open an account for their grandkid, whatever. So that fee minimum has risen from $800 a year previously to $1,200 a year. The second program is called Wealth Path. This is sort of a new service track for Mercer, newish, 2.5-3 years old. It is basically personalized portfolio management plus a financial plan. It's designed for the sub-$1 million client. That service track, the minimum has come up from $4,000 a year to $6,000 a year. And then there is also a custom wealth track, which is for the $1 million plus client. You'll have a dedicated advisor. I think they also give you some access to, like, you know, on-demand estate planning, on-demand tax prep. I don't know if it's prep or tax strategy. I think maybe just strategy. Be careful with that. And so that program now charges a minimum fee of $15,000 a year, up from $10,000. So I'll pause there.
Okay, so they've all gone up by 50%. They're all, to lesser degrees or to certain degrees, sort of lower touch, simplified services. They're not perhaps the sort of the full offering for the highest of net worth clients. Although, you know, one does wonder, you know, at a million plus, what am I doing wrong here? Could I not get the thing? But and the idea being what, that those asset levels, whilst they don't have minimums, they don't have asset minimums. They obviously do have a minimum that they need to make off those clients to service them at some form of profit.
That's right. And I think the idea, so, you know, I mean, these minimums are obviously only charged to clients who don't have enough AUM to generate that amount of fees.
Just on the AUM fee.
Just on the AUM
alone. Do they pay an AUM fee as well?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. Let me not say yes if I don't know that, actually. That's a good question. I will check on that. I do know that the idea, generally speaking, is that this, more often than not, I mean, if it's somebody like me who's got, you know, however much in a pretty basic brokerage account, like, you're probably not going to Mercer for portfolio management. I think generally this applies to the, you know, privately held business owner type client who maybe all of their net worth is concentrated in one illiquid place. And a lot of the work that needs to be done in order to serve that client happens before a sale. So I think this is like when those type of clients approach Mercer can take them on, do that work, you know, profitably, fairly to them. And then once the investable assets are freed up, for example, through a private business sale, they would graduate on to just an AUM fee, given that their assets probably generates, you know, far beyond those minimums.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And like you said, there are things in there that cost them money. I think you mentioned sort of estate planning, maybe tax.
And I think some of those auxiliary services were added more recently to these down market service tracks. So this is their way of saying, okay, we're giving, the down market client more, essentially. And so we deserve to be compensated, which, fair play. I mean, 50% sounds like a big hike. The dollar amounts may not be huge, but again, in relative terms, that makes a difference, right? I mean, if you've got a few hundred thousand dollars, the difference between a $4,000 and a $6,000 minimum, I mean, that could be the difference between 2%, 3%, maybe more on your portfolio.
Yeah, that's interesting. I suppose as well, this is an unfair question to ask. I mean, have we seen, off the top of your head, and Ian, I lean on you here with your sort of encyclopedic memory, have we seen many fee hikes this sort of over the last year? We know, and I think we've spoken about on the podcast before, how difficult it can be for RIAs and wealth managers of all stripes really to serve quote unquote smaller clients. We know that's a ridiculous thing to say when we're talking about people with like $1 million, but that's the reality of the business. Yeah, we know that's always been a sort of very difficult circle to square.
So I can't think off the top of my head of firms that have explicitly raised fees. What I will say is that, to Andrew's point, there have been firms that have experimented with stuff like this, setting a minimum fee threshold and then having them graduate. So to answer your question, I went back in the old mental coffers and I dug up a story from 2019 I remember writing about.
That is back. That's far.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Gone back almost 6 years. But I distinctly remember talking to Brent Berdesky back in 2019. He rolled out a program called the Savant Accelerator Program, which started at a minimum fee of $2,500. And the goal was that it basically, that fee ratcheted up over time until a traditional 1% AUM fee made more sense for the firm and generated more fee revenue. So essentially, the way that I view these kinds of programs philosophically is it's basically giving Mercer a chance to free roll these clients where they're still high earners, not necessarily rich yet, keep them on the platform, make money off them, and then eventually graduate them to a 1% fee. I think the issue is when you think about what these minimum fees look like in percentage terms, it is significantly more expensive on a raw percentage basis than just paying a 1% fee. So Andrew, can you pull up the math you did?
Yeah, it was something like, I mean, if you're in a, and I alluded to this just now, like if you're in the wealth path, program. You know, that's the middle out of the three tracks that, that we've identified and that, that are affected here by these fee hikes. And you have...
That's sub 1 million.
Sub 1 million. If you've got 200 grand... your minimum fee of $6,000 a year is a 3% fee on that portfolio, which is very high.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, but I
comparatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because then you've got people on, yeah, it's not progressive, is it? Because then you've got people on much higher portfolios, AUM sums, who obviously are getting paid, you know, sorry, rather are paying, yeah, 1%, probably sub 1%, getting lots of breaks as the assets go up, etc. But again, look, we, as we all know, the economics of wealth management means that, you know, firms are much more dependent on a few big clients than they are on lots of smaller clients.
This has been the trouble with the robo-advice model, right? I mean, this is why the few prevailing independent robos are transitioning into like digital wealth platforms. And I mean, they're breaking out of just the automated investing space because the margins are just so thin and the clients are, in relative terms, so small.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's really interesting. I mean, again, you don't see a lot of fee hikes, but we'll keep our eyes peeled for further ones of these. And it'd be interesting to kind of find out more. You know, I think there's probably a good piece in here somewhere that we should try and write before any of our competitors listening have a go at it, on sort of how some of the larger RIAs are handling sort of smaller clients and things. Because I think to your point, Andrew, you know, you do need to keep that next gen pipeline coming through. You're probably, your best chance of doing that is working with the descendants of your current clients rather than going out and starting from scratch and, you know, doing TikToks and whatever it is that someone would tell
YouTube
you to
marketing,
do. Yeah, exactly. This is probably your best shot. You know, it's all, well, it's frankly your best shot at keeping the money you already have. But yeah, do you just, I suppose some firms probably do it at a loss, hoping that, you know, they make that money again in the future, and versus not doing it like that. Excellent. Well, thank you, Andrew, and of course, Ian, for those two top stories to kick off 2026. Now, look, this is an early New Year episode. We can't, I think contractually, all branches of media have to use these things to do some predictions. It's just not allowed otherwise. So what we're not going to do is give you any macro allocation calls, because I think the whole of Wall Street spent December doing that. Some of them even got out early. I feel like it's like Christmas now. You just, they go earlier and earlier with the forecasts. You know, some of them coming out in November. But I think, look, it would be instructive and, dare I say, even fun for us to have a think about what might happen this year in the RIA space. Now, before we do this, a couple of key ground rules. First one, no one is allowed to say a mega merger. Okay, I think it's trite, and we've all done it too many times before. The other one, I think no one can say something as vague as AI is going to revolutionize the space. We might even get our producer to put sort of beeps over the word AI and mega merger as if we're cursing sort of frivolity that we're into at the start of the year. So, with those rules in place, which does make it a little harder, Ian, I'm going to start with you. What's your big call for 2026?
So before we get into it, I can save Alan a lot of work. So one thing I do that really annoys my wife is that when we play Scrabble and she plays a word that is not a word, or we're playing blocks and he puts a move down that's illegal, I make a very annoying buzzer sound. So I can supply that if one of us says AI right there.
Okay. Well, are you going to do the sound or not?
I'll do it if one of you guys does.
Oh, okay. All right. I think give us like a sample. All right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Predictions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that my prediction is, and I'll take a little bit of a weasel away around some of our restrictions, is we reported, I believe it was around early last year, that Blackstone was thinking about doing a transaction in the wealth space that was going to be structured, not the traditional style control PE investment. And my prediction is that we're going to see them get something done this year. That's not based on inside knowledge or anything like that. It's something I want to report on, but I still find it hard to believe that the largest private equity firm in the world is going to completely stay on the sidelines of one of the hottest spaces for private investment in the entire country. I have to imagine they're going to try to get something done soon.
Yeah. So just to circle back to the story, March last year, when Blackstone Ways RIA deal via what was then 37 billion tactical opportunities unit. March last year. No investment by Blackstone is imminent, but the company has been evaluating the idea of a wealth management investment internally, and discussions are in early stages. So yeah, we're round about the time frame, aren't we? You know? Brilliant. Okay, well, I look forward hopefully to reading it, and very much hopefully reading it on citywire.com/RIA. Andrew, and that's completely within the rules, by the way, I should say, because yeah, what we were talking about when the mega mergers is... There you go. Yeah, exactly. Just to be clear of that ground rule, what we were saying is, you know, a Wegg and a Mercer, a creative planning and a whatever, Marty Bicknell for Mariner, you know, that's what we're not allowed to predict. Andrew.
I'll just say, Ian, I could tell you turn it up to about maybe 15% on that, yes, buzzer sound. You could have let that ring and you held back, and that took real restraint. So kudos to you. I don't know. I mean, I'll sort of echo what I don't know. A lot of folks that I talk to seem to have this same prediction, and it's not specific to 2026, but just kind of more so where we're at in terms of the consolidation wave. I think just, yeah, more consortium deals, new private equity entrants, and sovereign wealth funds. I think all three of those, that we've seen all of those like ramp up a little bit in 25. I think all of that is going to continue and accelerate in 26. That may be like kind of boring, but I think every private equity firm that isn't exposed to this currently is chomping at the bit for exposure. And I mean, I don't know, we've heard of tons of firms that are looking for a deal, a first deal. And that might seem like late in the game for us, but I think you'll see a lot of new entrants, including sovereign funds, which may have some down market, sort of implications for like data security. So all of that will sort of be interesting to see how that shakes out. But that's my take on it.
Sovereign funds, it almost edges in to the mega merger. There you go. It almost, because that's
just on the right side though. Come on.
I don't know. You had another prediction as well before.
I think
you were going to borrow one from Lewis Diamond.
I was, but it sort of ties in with what Ian said. Now, Lewis was one of the contributors to a kind of, you know, bold predictions kind of roundup piece that we did on that floating Friday right after the new year. And he, his take was that there will be a large asset management brand with meaningful kind of brand knowledge around the country that enters the space in a big way. And I think Ian's call fits squarely into that peg. And his take was it'll either be, you know, large asset manager, venture fund, PE sponsor, enters the wealth management space itself in a big way. So not the same as a PE firm backing an existing RA, but the actual brand itself will be a real difference maker.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Well, it sort of ties in, but there's enough nuance between those two, I think, to give it, to make it worthwhile. You know what I was going to do? I was going to use this time while you guys were speaking to try and think of some sort of, you know, amazing, cutting, brilliant forecast. But I really don't have one, to be honest with you.
Leave it to the experts.
I think I will. Ian, did you have any more to offer?
I do think that we might be talking about an RA actually trying to IPO sooner rather than later. Whether that's this year or 27, that remains to be seen. But I think that momentum is quietly building towards that happening at some point soon.
Yeah, no, I can get on board with that, particularly, and I said we'd sort of avoid just doing sort of market outlooks, but you know, it's an awful lot of people predicting another good year for, you know, for US markets. And if, you know, rates come down, etc., could be a nice environment. Could be really interesting. I mean, I think it actually very quickly ties in slightly with Andrew's point. You're seeing maybe the opposite happening in big asset management, sort of traditional asset management, with that Janus Henderson deal to go private. And it's interesting divergence there with many sort of listed asset managers. Here you go. Here's a prediction. Although it's not pure RAA, I think you might see more sort of traditional asset managers that are listed a la Janus Henderson start to actually go the other way and do more of what, you know, as we well know, financial firms tend to have a better valuation on the private markets than they do on the public markets. So we might see some of
those.
We've
never talked about that on this show before. Never.
Yeah, literally all the time. Well, look, we're going to, you know, it's a new year, but the conversation is broadly the same one. And you know what? It's a good conversation. So on that note, we're going to leave it there. Ian, thank you very much. Fantastic to see you again.
Thank you.
Andrew, lovely to have you in the studio. Hopefully you'll be joining us a few more times this year.
Absolutely.
Listener, thank you for tuning in again. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.